May it please the court. I'd first like to thank you all for giving me and the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel the opportunity to appear here today to explain our recommendation in this particular disciplinary case, to answer any questions that you might have. It's truly an honor and a privilege for me, one that I relish and take advantage of when asked by Mr. Bratzel to argue and brief a case. I'm not as excited about the briefing aspect, but certainly this opportunity is one that I really enjoy. So
we'll ask you at the end if you still agree.
I'm sorry? yes, well, I'm anxious to hear some of the questions that we may I may be faced with. You know, the facts in this particular disciplinary case really are not in dispute. The case originated out of Region 4, which is Kansas City, Jackson County. It originated by a self-report by Mr. Russell on behalf of the respondent, Ms. Savory, and also was followed immediately by two letters, one from the prosecuting attorney in Jackson County and the other from the Judge Garrett, who sits in Division 26 in the 16th Judicial Circuit. The facts are plainly set out in the brief, and I'd be happy to reiterate any of the facts
or
answer questions.
Could you make clear what you said? You said complaints were made by the prosecutor and by the judge, but before that, how was it brought to your attention?
It was brought to our attention by a self-report, a letter written by Mr. Russell on behalf of the respondent.
And that was a self-reporting of what conduct?
Of the conduct that occurred in Division 26 during a preliminary hearing involving the case of State versus White.
So it was the self-reporting on that incident rather than on the other incident with the representation of counsel?
Correct. The information contained two counts. One involved conduct during the preliminary hearing. The second count involved a matter involving a gentleman by the name of Mr. Thomas in a civil case that he believed the respondent had not adequately represented him in connection with. So,
and what's the time frame of the two incidents?
The conduct that occurred in count two was actually preceded the preliminary hearing, but the complaint was not filed until probably 3 or 4 months later. I think we were originally, the letter was in December of 2011. I received the file, as I would do as special representative in Region 4, probably in early 12, and I think the Thomas complaint came in April of 2012.
I know you're recommending your offices that attorney here be suspended and be placed on probation. You say pursuant to the standard terms of probation. What in particular in the terms of probation will assure us that such a deception will never occur again by this attorney?
There's nothing in the conditions of the probation that will ensure anything without her cooperation. I can assure you that Mr. Pratzel and his office will monitor the conduct and the conditions very carefully. I believe the conditions are onerous. I've done this for quite some time. I have recommended conditions as part of diversion agreements, probations, over and over since 1989. These are the most onerous that I can remember, especially dealing with this conduct. But there's no way to assure that it would.
But what about a mentor? You know, some type of monitoring, some type of instruction, so that she understands that this is not acceptable behavior.
One of the conditions of the probation is that she have a mentor. There has been an individual that's been named by Dana Tippin Cutler in Kansas City, who has agreed to act in that capacity. Mm-hmm. There's another gentleman by the name of Jim Hall, who is a very fine lawyer, municipal court lawyer, judge in many jurisdictions, that's also offered to assist. John Kurtz, who testified at the disciplinary hearing before the panel, also has offered his assistance. And I would urge you to look at that part of the transcript or that part of the appendix if you have not. It would be in volume one of the record, and I believe it begins at a page 31. But his testimony was quite persuasive as to why he believed Ms. Savory has ended up in this position. He's known her for a number of years, and what help he could offer her. So in answer to your question, Judge, I think there's no way to assure that anyone's going to comply with conditions, but I can assure you that we'll do our best to monitor. I think she'll have quite a bit of help. It will be a difficult task for her to accomplish all of these conditions. She seems to be willing to do that, and it readily signed off on the stipulation. So I'm comfortable from my investigation that will occur. As I said, for the most part, the facts and the rule violations have always been admitted. The case is about what is the appropriate discipline. The case is about a young lawyer from the urban core in Kansas City, Missouri, who worked her way through a Kansas City, Missouri school district, through a university setting, and through law school to get a license to practice law and to help people. And that is what she wants to do. That's what we believe she will continue to do. She made a gross mistake. She made a huge mistake. I don't think there was any selfish motive that would have explained the conduct. Her motive was as to acquit her client. Her client was charged with a purse snatching. There was an issue of cross-racial identification. She had come from a two-year stint at the public defender's office. She believed that there would be an opportunity for her at this preliminary hearing to have her client acquitted. She made horrible mistakes, and when the judge asked for her where her client was, instead of at that point standing up and doing the right thing and addressing the court in private or back in chambers or however the case may be about what her plan was, she got caught up into the situation according to her testimony, and it unraveled from there. I thought it was interesting that, and I too have done a lot of investigation in this case, and I've talked to a number of judges in the area. It's not a part of the record, and I offer it only to assure you that there is a comfort level in Region 4 in the circuit court among the judges that I've talked to, certainly the municipal court, about the respondent and her conduct. Everyone believes that this is the appropriate disposition because, at least in my mind, I believe she needs some mentoring help. I think she will benefit by having some CLE. She's required to do 15 hours of CLE, to attend ethics school, to do the solo and small firm conference, and also to take and pass the MPRE. That's quite a lot. It's
more. Is it 15 hours in addition to the 15 hours?
That's correct,
she's required to take anyway?
You're right, Your Honor. That's correct. I mean, I think
am I correct? She's also going to get involved in ends of court.
I believe that she's done that on her own. I think that was a part of the respondent's brief that I wasn't aware of until it was filed. All of those are good things. All of those are things to try to help her to be a better lawyer so that we can protect the public. And I understand that public protection is one of the main goals, but the integrity of the profession has taken a hit with this case. Sadly, I don't know how you repair that. There's no way you can make it a condition of the probation that she somehow not.
Does Judge Garrett know about the proposed discipline? And you said you talked to everyone around. Does he know?
Yes, Judge. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you asked because as a part of my preparation for the hearing, for the disciplinary hearing panel, I contacted Judge Garrett to offer him an opportunity to come and speak to the disciplinary hearing panel. He was very upset. Again, the record volume that the appendix was filed as a part of my brief, there's a transcript of the original preliminary hearing. He was very upset at that time, but he too assured me that he didn't feel a need to come and testify. He was very confident in Alan Pratzel, a common sense approach to the particular case and what the ultimate outcome was. So no, he didn't feel a need to come and offer any further testimony. I think it's important to point out that not only is Ms. Savory young, has no previous disciplinary history, that the motives clearly weren't anything to do with her self-interest. There's no indication that, at least in my mind, that she was motivated other than, as I said earlier, to try to have her client acquitted. I don't believe it's a case where there's a threat to the public, there's no trust account issues, there's been no substance abuse allegations, no mental health issues.
How about count two?
I'm sorry?
Count two.
I have not addressed much about count two because in my mind, standing alone, count two would not even be in front of this court. If count two were the only violation that were being addressed at this point, it more likely than not would have been resolved with an admonition out of my particular.
Even so, having two counts makes it clearly makes different it than one.
It makes it an aggravating factor, which the court could consider because it does make it multiple offenses. So I would certainly agree with that. And the dishonest motive is also an aggravating factor. But there are a number of mitigating factors, which I'll let Mr. Russell go through with you. All of those were considered, however, when we were doing our analysis based upon the ABA standards, the case law. There certainly isn't any case law that I could find that would address this particular type of issue. But an isolated incident, no personal gain. I believe that under the circumstances, the disciplinary hearing panel's recommendation to this court is the appropriate one. And I would urge you to give deference to those good people that work so hard, volunteering their time to take evidence in these type of cases and to make the recommendations that they feel appropriate. We have a lot of volunteers in the system that work very, very hard to benefit not only you, but Mr. Pratzel and myself and the system as a whole. And in this particular case, I think the right result has been reached, and I would urge you to consider the recommendations that they've made.
Mr. Thomas indicates that he thinks respondent's conduct caused him to lose the right to bring the negligence claim. In your investigation, what did you find regarding that allegation?
I found that he was unable to find any other attorney to represent him other than Ms. Savory prior to this, and was not able to find any lawyer. Oh, he did find an attorney to help him finalize his case, and he was able to settle the contractual part of his case, but claims that he had lost some claim of negligence, with the specifics of which I don't know.
Well, that was my question as to why he lost that, and maybe Mr. Russell can advise us.
Thank you, counsel. You have time on rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. If you would indulge me a moment, I'd like to go through just a little history as it relates both to me and to the system. When I left the bench in 1986, first matter that I was either fortunate or unfortunate enough to handle was a judicial discipline proceeding involving Judge Tom Elliston of Joplin, who was serving on the Commission on Retirement Removal and Discipline at that time. And I had been a former member of that commission, and he thought my experience would be helpful and assisted him. We heard that case for 5 days in Joplin. It had considerable notoriety. At the end of it, I would say the reviews were mixed as to whether we achieved a good result or a poor result. But at any rate, for whatever reason, I started getting requests from lawyers to handle lawyer discipline cases. And it didn't take me very long to establish a practice for me, and that is that if I'm going to represent a lawyer, if the lawyer has violated the rules of professional conduct, I require that they admit that they violated the rules. And they have to acknowledge that the conduct not only violates the rules, but was wrongful, and they have to agree that we will try to proceed and deal with the case based on our admissions and try to reach a reasonable result in regard to discipline based on the history of the lawyer and the context in which the misconduct occurred. And that's worked very well for me for the most part, and it's been an approach that has been fairly well accepted with the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel and prior Chief Disciplinary Counsel. But what I found was that for a number of years, The way we handled those cases was by stipulation, many times prior to the filing of an information. And we filed a stipulation of fact and recommended discipline. And it was filed directly in this court. And the court then basically signed off on those stipulations. And you can tell your client without really reservation that that's what was going to happen. When you made the agreement was in all likelihood going to be observed and approved. That happened to continue to, I would say, maybe 3 years ago, when the court started saying, we want you to brief and argue these cases. And I'm not sure yet exactly what the thought process is on the court for that, but I appreciate the fact that you may want to see more deeply into these than appears many times on the record. But I want to assure you that these stipulations and agreements are not entered into lightly between counsel and counsel for the informant. They get a lot of work. There's a lot of time and energy that goes into them. And when you're dealing with a probation situation, as we have in this situation where it's going to be recommended, we confer with Carl Schaefer-Cotter, who is the lawyer who oversees those programs, and we talk at great length about where these things are going and what can we do. And that certainly happened in this case. We also came to the conclusion several years ago that maybe it would be helpful to the court if instead of reaching these agreements and then filing them with the court, they would say, what about we take these to the DHP and let the disciplinary hearing panel look at what we have agreed to, three new sets of eyes, and tell us whether it's reasonable or not. Bring the respondent to the disciplinary hearing panel so they have the opportunity to discuss the case with the lawyers and to ask questions and observe the respondent. And that's been the practice, and that is, of course, what happened in this case. And I would suggest to you that briefing and arguing these kind of cases where there has been a stipulation, to me, creates a delay in the proceedings. It creates uncertainty. It makes it difficult when you're trying to advise your client whether to accept this or not accept this. They want to know what's the likelihood the court's going to sign off on this. I don't know. I have a guess there's a good chance. The court has spoken and said that once a case goes to a disciplinary hearing panel, the decision of the disciplinary hearing panel is entitled to considerable weight. And certainly it should be. I would suggest to you that maybe it ought to go farther than that, that in these cases where there has been a stipulation between the OCDC and Respondents Council, it's been looked at, everybody has worked at it. These are people who are reasonable to deal with, but they're not giving away the store, I can assure you. And I would suggest to you that maybe the standard of review and the standard of whether you have these cases briefed and argued might well be, they ought to be presumed to be correct, absent some compelling reason to have them briefed and argued, which might be that there's a case out there that you think is contrary to what has been agreed to, or that there is a ABA standard that is contrary to that.
What if the decision-making process and trying to decide what discipline cases to hear involve the importance of the issue involved.
I agree with you.
You know, that the oath you take is about four paragraphs, and one of them says that I will never seek to mislead the judge or jury by any artifice of false statement or law of fact.
Absolutely.
That isn't a difficult thing for those of us in the justice system to know is necessary for it to work and to rely on people like you and your opposing counsel in this case.
Well,
and so what's how are we to deal with a situation where this type of activity isn't the type of thing that probation usually helps with, is my concern. Never means not one time.
I truly, Judge, disagree with you that probation is not appropriate. You all have invoked a rule that provides for probation, and as Mr. Gottschall has indicated, the conditions in this case are as onerous as any as you could find. But I, going back to what I said earlier about accepting these cases, you need to look at the context in which they occur, and you need to look at who Dorothy Savory is. And she's a young lady from what would be termed the worst zip code in Kansas City. And she, on her own bootstraps, got through college, got through law school, and has been out trying to live the dream that she had to be a lawyer. I suggest to you that this moment that she had when she decided she was going to use this twin thing for an identification situation was something that you might expect on some TV show of some kind. And I just don't think she had the sophistication to understand it. And unlike people like me who were fortunate enough to go through law school, to get a job with a federal judge, to go with a firm where all these things are in place, she's out by herself trying to make a living with very little insight. And I don't think she really understood until the vice began to close that she understood she was making a representation to the court. And it was a misrepresentation. That's, I can assure you, she has been absolutely as remorseful as anybody I've ever seen. She has never argued about the proposed conditions of probation. In talking about what she has done to date, she has gotten involved with the Ends of Court program at the Ross Roberts Inn in Kansas City. She has already obtained malpractice insurance. She's done the solo and small firm conference. She has worked closely already with Dana Tippin Cutler, who is an African-American lady lawyer in Kansas City. And I think the proof is in the pudding thus far. She's not having any problems. She's doing very well under very onerous conditions. And I can't say she will never do anything like this again, but I feel very confident in saying it is really unlikely that she ever would.
She's been in practice since 2005 and never had a bar complaint before then, true? Yeah. Has she always worked in the criminal defense field?
Well, criminal defense, she's kind of limited her practice now more to traffic, whether you want to call that criminal defense or not, since most of that's municipal ordinance violations. But yeah, she was in the defender's office for a period of time. She initially started off clerking in Georgia, but that was not a criminal situation. But I mean, her problems really began when she went out on her own. I think she was very ill-equipped to run her own law firm and try to keep up with all the things. And as so many young lawyers have, they wonder where the next client's coming from and what are they going to do, how's it going to work. And she took cases she shouldn't take. Ms. Breckenridge asked about the Thomas case, a case she shouldn't have taken. It was not a very good case to begin with. It had very little prospect of being successful. He couldn't find anybody except Dorothy to handle the case. And had she been thinking about it, she would have read that flag that after somebody's been to see two or three other lawyers and they come to see you, it's probably good reason for you to say, wait a minute, I'm not real interested in doing this either.
Did she have did she consult with, they used to have a program at the Missouri Bar run by Linda Ollingslager, who's now retired, but I'm sure they have someone else doing it, on law office management and to, has she taken a course in law office management, ticker systems, and the mentor, I assume, would advise her. Of course, Dana Tippin Cutler does defense insurance cases, but someone who advised her on her kind of cases.
That's great.
What you should take and what you shouldn't take.
Yes.
Judge Hall, who is a judge in a number of municipalities and who has done a world of that work in his own practice, has been available for Dana Tippin Cutler has already been working with her, and she has got her office overhead pretty well under control and is doing very well with it.
Does she attend a law office management course or been involved in that or gotten consulting on how to set up a ticker system, how to set up an office?
That is a condition of the probation that she has not done as yet, but will do. We're dealing with the OCDC on trying to get approved programs that we think meet that requirement for her. But she is absolutely willing to do anything that is required of her. I have been very impressed with her, looking at where she came from and where she's gotten to, and I didn't have any real problem impressing upon her the gravity of what had occurred. She came to me, I mean, very, very shortly after this event happened. And
is there any follow-up, for example, at the legal aid? There's a legal service corporation that comes through every so often on a regular basis, and they check up. Do you have a ticker system? Are you working on, I mean, it's a huge operation. I know it's a huge operation in Kansas City. They check up. What is your ticker system? Let me see how it operates. Let me see how your cases are run. Does someone follow up besides taking a CLE program on whether or not the conditions are being followed and put in place?
Yeah, the follow-up is with the reports of the mentors. It's where that goes. I don't know that we have any access or ability to deal with the legal aid.
I'm just saying that's what they do.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the people in Washington come in. I've got a program of 50 lawyers. I mean, they're going through the system, not violating the confidentiality. We won't let that happen. But they're going through, I'm sure the same things in Kansas City, the same size program.
And our big concern.
Make sure you have that. If there's been and that's even without any evidence of any problem, to make sure you have all this stuff in place.
Well, I can only tell you that she has certainly worked in that direction. Have we hired a consultant as yet to do that? No. It's a fairly expensive proposition. Once, hopefully, this.
Or maybe there's something like the Missouri Bar or the OCDC that would go through and monitor and audit to make sure that, given there's an example of a situation that was that you say she acknowledges wasn't a good situation, but there's some smoke to make sure there's no more fire. Yeah. It doesn't have to be someone you hire, but it's basically someone who goes through and says, let me look at your ticker system.
And that is certainly contemplated by the order of probation and will be done.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
You describe stuff as you're arguing and you're opposing counsel. I don't see any opposition, nor any. I see agreeing, not so much arguing. It's okay.
It was the same situation the last time we were here, Your Honor. But that is because we've worked so hard to try to reach what we believe to be a fair and just conclusion and recommendation for you to look through, ask any questions that you want. More than happy to answer those. I'm a firm believer in second chances. I believe this lady can help people, especially limiting her practice the way she is, and especially in the community which she serves. She will help a lot of people. She made a mistake. We have tools in place now to address how to correct those situations. Mr. Mandel was here earlier telling you that he had appeared before this court many years ago. I, too, was here in 1990. At that time, I was arguing. There were no iPads at the time, by the way. I was arguing a case involving a very excellent workers' compensation lawyer by the name of Roger Staub. Roger had made some huge mistakes. I argued that if the purpose of the current disciplinary system is to protect the public and the integrity of the bar has failed miserably in this case, the only options are reprimand, suspension, or disbarment. The public will suffer as competent and successful attorneys are removed from their practices. Reprimands provide relief to attorneys that their cases are closed. suspensions serve only as interruptions and inconveniences. Disbarment is a harsh sanction. It should be reserved for those cases of severe misconduct. It should be final and non-reviewable. Chief Justice Roberson asked me, what do you propose we do? At the time, there was nothing to do. We had no probation rule. We now have a rule on conditional discipline. We have a rule on probation. It's a great tool for our office to use in these type of situations.
What activates the probation? Let's say, would a DWI then be a breach of probation, or would any other action other than the same thing, other than lying to a judge?
Yes.
Would anything else activate the probation?
It would be a DUI charge, certainly would be brought to the attention of the probation monitor, and it would be then up to the office, chief disciplinary counsel, to decide the severity of that particular incident, whether or not there should be a motion filed to revoke the probation. But certainly it's being monitored as any other criminal probation would, obey all laws, city, state, and federal, have no repeat violations, certainly always a part of any probationary requirement. But in this case, you know, the chances that there'll be a repeat violation of this particular conduct, in my opinion, are remote. There may be other violations. There may be people who file complaints. And if those do occur, the office will handle those. But I again would urge you to look carefully at the conditions that are proposed by the DHP, to give it great weight, and to adopt the findings that and the recommendation that they made.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under advisement.